Hi, this is Dana Gardner, Principal Analyst at Inner Harbor Solutions, and you're listening to Briefings Direct. Today we present a sponsored podcast discussion on the high and sometimes underappreciated costs for many enterprises of doing nothing about aging monolithic applications. Not making a choice about legacy, mainframe, and poorly used applications is, in effect, making a choice not to transform and modernize the applications and their supporting systems. Not doing anything is a choice to embrace an ongoing cost structure that may well prevent significant new spending for IT innovations. It's a choice to suspend applications on perhaps ossified platforms and make their reuse and integration difficult, complex, and costly. Doing nothing is a choice that, in a recession, hurts companies in multiple ways, because successful transformation is the lifeblood of near and long-term productivity improvements. Here to help us better understand the perils of continuing to do nothing about aging legacy and mainframe applications, we're joined by four IT transformation experts from Hewlett-Packard. Please join me in welcoming our guests. First, Brad Hipps, Product Marketer for Application Lifecycle Management and Applications Portfolio Software at HP. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you.
Also, John Pickett, Enterprise Storage and Server Marketing at HP. Hello, John.
Hi. Welcome.
Paul Evans, Worldwide Marketing Lead on Applications Transformation at HP. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Dana.
And Steve Woods, Application Transformation Analyst and Distinguished Software Engineer at EDS, an HP company. Good to have you with us, Steve.
Thank you, Dana.
Let me start off with going to Paul. You know, the recession has had a number of effects on people's thinking as well as budgets, but I wonder what in particular the tight cost structure has had on this notion of tolerating mainframe and legacy applications.
I think from our observations, Dana, what we're seeing is that last year you could say that the cost of legacy systems and the cost of supporting those with a mainframe hasn't changed in 12 months. What has changed is the, as it were, you could say, the available cash that companies have to spend on IT. And as over time that cash amount may have either been frozen or is being reduced, that puts even more pressure in terms of the IT department and the CIO on how to actually spend that money and where to spend that money and how to ensure alignment between what the business wants to do and where the technology needs to go. Given that the fact that we sort of knew already that only about 10% of an IT budget was spent on innovation before, the problem is, as that becomes squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, our concern is that there is like a cost of doing nothing, and that cost is that people eventually end up spending their whole IT budget on maintenance and upgrades and spend virtually nothing on innovation. And at a time when competitiveness is actually needed more than it was a year ago, then there has to be a shift in the way we spend our IT dollars and where we spend our IT dollars. And in our mind, that means looking at the legacy software environments and the underpinning infrastructure is absolutely a necessity.
All right, so clearly there's a shift in the economic impetus. I want to go to Steve Wood. As an analyst looking at these issues, what's changed technically in terms of reducing something that may have been a hurdle to overcome for application transformation?
Well, you know, for years, the biggest hurdle, and I think the most customers would say, was they didn't really have to make a decision because the performance wasn't there. The performance reliability was not there. That is there now. There's really no excuse not to move because of performance or reliability issues. What is still there, and I think is changing today, is the ability to look at a legacy source code application. We have the tools now to look at the code and visualize it in ways that are very compelling. And that's typically one of the biggest obstacles, because if you look at a legacy application and we look at the number of lines of code and the number of people that are maintaining it, it's obvious to us usually that large portions of the application haven't really changed much. It's a lot of library code and that sort of thing. And that's really important that we demonstrate to our customers that we have the ability to help them understand this large terrain of code that they might be afraid to move forward with because they simply don't understand it. Maybe the people who originally developed it have moved on, and because nobody really maintains it, they have a sort of fear of going into those areas of the system. Also, what has changed is the growth of architectural components such as extract, transform, and load tools, data integration tools, and reporting tools. So what we typically suggest suggests when we look at a large body of, say, 10 million lines of COBOL, and we find, you know, 3 million lines of that code is doing reporting, or maybe 2 million is doing extract, transform, and load work, we would suggest they move that asymmetrically to a new platform that does not use handwritten code, because that's really where the risk aversion there is, by doing it very incrementally, low intrusion, and that's also where the best ROI picture can be portrayed, is because you can incrementally get your return on investment as you move the reports and as you remove the data transformation jobs over to the new platform. So that really is what's changed. These tools have matured, that we have the performance, and we also have the tools to help them understand their legacy systems today.
All right. Now, one area where economics and technology come together quite well is hardware. Let's go to John in regards to virtualization, reduced cost of storage. How has that changed the landscape of a penalty increase for doing nothing?
You know, typically when we take a look at the high end of applications are going to be moving over and sitting on a legacy system. Many times they're sitting on a mainframe platform. And with that, one of the things that has changed over the last several years is that the functionality gap between what exists in the past, you know, a decade, 5 or 10 years ago, on the mainframe, that gap has not only been closed, but in some cases, open systems exceed what's available on the mainframe. So just from a functionality standpoint, there is certainly plenty of capability there. But to hit on the cost of doing nothing and implementing what you currently have today is that, you know, it's not only the high cost of the platform. As a matter of fact, one of our customers that had moved from a high-end mainframe environment onto an Integrity Superdome, that if you were to take their cost savings and to apply that to playing golf at one of the premier golf places in the world, Pebble Beach, that you could golf every day with you and three friends for essentially 42 years, 10 months, and a couple days. So it's not only a matter of cost, but it's also factoring in the power and cooling into that as well. Certainly what we've seen is that the cost savings that can be applied on the infrastructure side are then applied back into modernizing the applications, as you've heard here.
I suppose the true cost benefits wouldn't be realized until after some sort of a transformation. Back to Paul Evans, any indications from folks that have done this transformation as to how substantial their savings can be?
Yeah, I mean, there are many, many documented cases that HP can provide, and I think other vendors can provide as well, that in terms of actually looking at their applications and the underpinning infrastructure, as John was talking about, there are so many documented cases that point people in direction that there are real, real cost savings to be made here. And there's also a flip side to this. Some research that McKinsey did earlier in the year basically took a sample of 100 companies that went into the recession, as it were, as brand leadership companies, and yet coming out of the recession, only 60 of those companies were still in, as it were, a leadership position. 40 companies, 40% of those companies had, as it were, dropped by the wayside. Doesn't mean they got out of business. Some did. Some got acquired. But others just lost their brand leadership. I mean, that is a huge, huge price to pay. Now, not all of that is to do with application transformation. But we firmly believe that it is so pivotal in terms of the provision, as it were, of improved services, as it were, of revenue generation opportunities, that in tough times, the strong get stronger. And what we would say to organizations is, you know, take a hard look at this, because doing nothing could be absolutely the wrong thing to do. Having, as it were, a competitive differentiation that you continue to exploit to continue to provide customers with an improving level of service is to keep those customers at a tough time, which means they'll be your customers when you come out of the recession.
Let's go to Brad. So I'm also curious on a strategic level about flexibility and agility. Are there prices to be paid in terms of lock-in and fragility, or applications that don't easily lend themselves to a wider process that we should be considering?
This great term agility, which is the right term to use, but it gets used so often that people sort of tend to forget what it means. I think the reality of today's modern organization, and this is as contrasted even from 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, is that when we look at applications, they're everywhere. There has been an application explosion. When I started in the applications business, you know, we were working on a few handful of applications that basically organizations had. And so that was sort of the extent of the application in the business. It was one part of it, but it was not total. Now in every modern enterprise, applications really are total. Big, small, medium-sized, they're all over the place. When we start talking about application transformation and we assign that trend to agility, what we're really saying, what we're acknowledging is, for the business to make any change today in the way it does business, any new market initiative, any competitive threat it wants to respond to, there is going to be certainly an application, very likely applications, plural, that are going to need to be either built or changed to support whatever that new initiative is. And the fact of the matter is that that effort, changing or creating the applications to support the business initiative, becomes the long pole to realizing whatever it is that initiative is. So if that's the case, you obviously then begin to say, great, what are the things that I can do to shrink that time, to shrink that pole, if you will, that stands between me and getting this initiative realized in the market space? From an applications transformation perspective, we then take that as the context for everything that's motivating a business with regard to its applications. The decisions that you're going to make to transform your applications all should be pointed at and informed by shrinking the amount of time it then takes you to turn around and realize some business initiative. So that, in 500 words or less, is what we're seeking with agility. Following pretty closely behind that, you can begin to see why there's a promise in cloud. It saves me, obviously, a lot of infrastructural headaches. It's supposed to obviate a lot of the challenges I have around, obviously, just standing up the application and getting it ready, let alone having to build the application itself. So I think that is sort of the view of transformation in terms of agility and why we're seeing things like cloud and these other things really start to try to point the direction to greater agility.
Sounds as if there's a penalty to be paid, or perhaps certainly a risk to be incurred by being locked into the past.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think you then sort of take the reverse of that and you say, fine, if I want to sort of keep doing things as is, what that means is that virtually every day that goes by or every month that goes by, I add another application or I make bigger my current sort of application pool using older technologies that I know take me longer to make changes in. And if you will, in sort of the most dramatic terms, it only gets worse the longer I wait. That pool of sort of dated technology only gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The more changes that I have coming in, the more changes I'm trying to do. So the further out I look, effectively, I'm sort of, it's almost as though I've sort of got this ball and chain I've attached to my ankle, and I'm just letting that ball part get bigger and bigger and bigger. There is a very real agility cost, even setting aside what your competition may be doing.
And so as the inevitability of transformation goes from perhaps a long horizon to a much nearer and dearer issue, let's go back to Steve Woods at EDS. What are some misconceptions about starting on this journey? Is this really something that's going to highly disrupt an organization, or are there steps to do it incrementally? What might hold people back that perhaps shouldn't?
I think probably one of the biggest misconceptions is somebody who's has a large legacy application written in a second-generation language such as COBOL or perhaps PL1, is they look at the code and they imagine a future with still having handwritten code, but they imagine maybe it will be in Java, perhaps it will be in C# and .NET. And they don't take the next step and say, well, really, if I had to look at the system and rebuild it today, would I do it the same way? Because that's what you're doing if you just imagine one path to modernization. Certainly, some of their code that houses their business logic might find their way into some classes in Java and some classes in .NET. But what we prefer to do is do a functional breakdown on what the code is actually doing. What is the code doing? And what we then try to imagine is, well, listen, what are the options that we have going forward? Certainly some of it will become handwritten code, and certainly some of it will move to those sorts of implementations. But we really would like to look at what the code is doing and imagine other areas that we could possibly implement those changes in. And if we do that, then we have a much better approach to moving them. The worst thing to do, I think, and then a lot of customers have this impression, is to automatically translate the code from Java or from COBOL into Java. Java and C# are very efficient languages. To generate a function point, which is a measure of functionality, in Java takes about 8 or 10 lines of code, and COBOL it takes about 108 lines. typically when you translate automatically from COBOL to Java, you still get pretty much the same amount of code. In actuality, you've taken the maintenance headache and made it even larger by doing this automated translation. So we prefer to take a much more thoughtful approach, look at what the options are, and put together an incremental modernization strategy.
Paul Evans, this really isn't so much pulling the plug on the mainframe, which perhaps might give people some shivers. They might not know what to expect over a period of decades, what might happen when they pull the plug, but a bit more of a continuum.
Yeah, I mean, what we don't profess is that people unplug mainframes. I mean, if they want to and they plug in an HP system in its place, we'd love them to. But I think being very pragmatic, which is what we like to be, I think it's what we would say, it's looking, as Steve was talking about, it's looking at the code, it's looking at what you want to do from a business process standpoint, looking at the underlying platform, understanding what sort of, as it were, quality of service you need to deliver, and then, as it were, understanding the options available to you. And in our mind, the advances in even base technologies like, you know, as it were, microprocessors, the sort of power that can be delivered these days means we can do all sorts of things at prices and speed and, as it were, size and power output and CO2 emissions that we could only dream of a few years ago. And this power enabled us to do all sorts of things. So that I think the days where there was this, as it were, walled-off area, as it were, within the data center that, you know, no other technology could match is long gone. But I think the point being now is, whereas the emphasis for many years has been on consolidation and virtualization, I think now there is also a big, big focus in and around, as it were, legacy modernization. Because I think CIOs, IT directors, whatever they may be, do understand that there is an awful lot of money spent on maintaining, as it were, Steve said, handwritten legacy code that today runs the organization and needs to continue to provide those business processes. But there are far faster, cheaper, and better ways to do that. But it has to be something that is planned for. It has to be something that is executed flawlessly. And that, you know, if there is a long-term view, but you take bite-sized chunks out of it along the way so that you get the results you need, then you can feed those good results back into the system. And then you get an upward spiral of people seeing what is truly possible with today's technologies.
John Pickett, any other misconceptions or perhaps underappreciated points of information from the enterprise storage and server perspective?
Typically when we see the legacy system, what we hear often in a marketing sense is that often, you know, high-end, and I'll just use as an example, mainframes could be used as a consolidation factor. And what we find is if you're going to be moving applications or modernizing applications onto an open system environment, to take advantage of the full gambit of tools and open system applications that are out there, you're not going to be doing that on a legacy environment. So certainly we see the a much more efficient way of going down that path is onto an open standard server platform. Also, some of the other misconceptions that we see as well, and again, we hear in a marketing sense that perhaps a mainframe is very efficient. However, if you compare that to a high-end HP system, for example, that if you just take a look at the heat output, which we know is very important, that there's more heat. The difference in heat between a mainframe and an Integrity Superdome, for example, is enough to power a two-gas grill, Weber grill. So certainly some significant heat there as well. On the energy side, we see that the Superdome produces 42% less energy. So certainly a very efficient way of handling the operating system environment when you do modernize these applications.
Brad Hipps, when we talk about modernizing, we're not just modernizing applications, it's really modernizing the architecture. What benefits, perhaps underappreciated, come with that move?
It's true. I tend to think about, you know, application transformation in my sort of catchphrase, if that's the word for it, is that in most ways it's a breaking up and distributing of that which was previously self-contained and closed. Whether you're looking at moving from sort of a mainframe processing to distributed processing, from distributed processing to virtualization, whether you're talking about the application teams themselves, which now are some combination of in-house, nearshore, offshore, outsourced, so sort of a distribution of the teams from sort of a single building to all around the world. Certainly the architectures themselves, from being these sort of these these monolithic and fairly brittle things that are now, you know, sort of services-driven things. And you can look at any one of those trends and you can begin to speak about benefits, whether it's leveraging a better sort of global cost basis or, you know, on the architectural side. I think the fundamental element we're trying to do is we're trying to say, look, let's move away from a world in which everything is handcrafted, if you will, and let's get much closer to the assembly line model, where I have a series of pre-existing trustworthy components, and I know where they are, and I know what they do, and my work now becomes really a matter of assembling those, and they can sort of take any variety of shapes I might need because of the components I've created. But we're getting back to this idea of sort of lower cost, increased agility. We can only imagine. You can only imagine how certain car manufacturers would be doing if they're handcrafting every car. We moved to the assembly line for a reason, and I think software typically has sort of lagged what we see in other engineering disciplines, but here we're finally beginning to catch up. We're finally beginning to recognize, hey, we can take an assembly line approach to the creation of applications as well with all the intended benefits.
Right, and when you standardize the architecture, you can, instead of having to make sure there's a skill set located where the systems are,
That's right. You can
perhaps bring the systems to where the skills are.
That's right. You can begin to divorce your resources from the asset that they're creating, and you're absolutely right. That's another huge and tremendous thing that we see, and that's true whether you're talking about a service or a component of an application, whether you're talking about a test asset, whatever the case may be. We can envision a series of assets that sort of make an application successful. And you can now, those can be distributed and divorced, geographically divorced, from the owners.
Whereas this has been a sort of nice to have or something on the back burner activity, we're starting to see it emerge as a top priority. And I've heard of some new Forrester research that has shown that legacy transformation is becoming perhaps the number one priority. Paul, can you offer some more insight on that?
That's research that we've ourselves seen as well, Dana. And in a way, I mean, I suppose even though I'm one of the most passionate, as it were, application transformation people around, I always think, sometimes to my own cost. But the point being is that this may not be what organizations want to do. You know, turn to a CIO and say, hey, if we give you, $10 million, what is it you'd really like to do? What they're actually saying is this is what they know they've got to do. So there's a difference between what they like and what they've got to. But I think that goes back to when we started in terms of the current economic situation and the pressure it's bringing to bear on people, is that I think the time is up when people just continue to spend their dollars on maintaining, the applications that Steve's talked about and that Brad's talked about and the infrastructure that John's talked about, and just to continue to pour money after that. There has to be a break point. Someone has got to say, stop, this is crazy. There are better ways to do this. And I think what the Forrester research is pointing is that you go around a worldwide audience, you talk to, 1,000 people in influential positions, they actually are now saying, this is what we have to do. Not what we want to do, but we're going to do this, and we're going to take time out, and we're going to do it properly. We're going to take cost out of what we're doing today, and it's not going to come back. And all the things that, say, Steve and Brad have talked about in terms of handwritten code, I mean, once we've done it, once we have removed that handwritten code, that code that is too big for what it needs to be in terms to get the job done, once we've done it once, it's out and it's finished with. And then we can start looking at economics that are totally different going forward, where we can effectively flip this ratio. Today, we may spend 80 or 90% of our IT budget on maintenance, 10% on innovation. What we want to do is flip it. Now, we're not going to flip it in a year or maybe even two, but we've got to take steps. If we don't start taking steps, it'll never go away.
This is Brad. Just one thing to add to that. I mean, I think it's in terms of sort of the maybe aura of inevitability that is sort of coming with the transformation. I think when you look at, historically over the last 30 years, you look at IT, you can see that fairly consistently, you can pick your time frame, but somewhere in the neighborhood of every 7 to 9 years, there's been sort of an equivalent wave of modernization. And so the last major one we went through was sort of late 90s, early 2000, with the combination of Y2K and Web 1.0. And so, sure enough, here we are kind of right on time with the next wave. But what's interesting in terms of is this now the number one priority or is this sort of, has this reached the stage of inevitability? I look back historically and think about what organizations by, say, 2003 were still saying, nope, I refuse the web. I refuse the network world. It's not going to happen. It's a passing fancy, whatever the case may be. In as much as there were organizations doing that, I suspect they're not around anymore, or they're around in a much smaller much smaller sense than they were. And I do think that's, you know, I do think effectively that's where we are now. A cloud is reasonably new, but, you know, outsourcing, which is another component of a transformation, has been around long enough that most people have been able to look at square in the eye and figure out, you know what, there's a real benefit here. Yes, there's some things I need to do on my side to realize that benefit. There's no such thing as a free lunch, but there's a real benefit here, and it's I'm going to suffer, if not next year, then 3 years from now, if I don't start getting my act together now.
John Pickett, are there any messages from the boosters of mainframes that perhaps are no longer factors or even misleading?
I think that there's certainly a couple of those. Certainly in the past, when mainframe was thought to be the harbinger of RAS, the reliability, availability, and serviceability, you know, many of those features exist on open systems today. So it's not something that is dedicated just to the high end of a mainframe environment. They're out there on systems that are open system platforms, significantly cheaper, and in many cases, the RAS of these systems far exceeds what you'll see on the mainframe. And that's, you know, that's just one piece. I mean, other misconceptions, things that you typically see or historically have seen on the mainframe side. So being able to drive business-based objectives, to be able to prioritize resources for different applications or different groups of users, well, that's something that has existed for you know, a number of years on the open system side. Things such as backup and recovery, you know, being able to provide very high levels of disaster recovery. I think the misconception that, you know, this is something that can only be done in a mainframe environment not only is misleading, but also for not making the move to an open system platform continues to drive IT budget unnecessarily into an infrastructure that could be applied to either the application monetization that we've been talking about here or into skills, so people resources within the data center.
We seem to have a firm handle on the cost benefits over time, certainly a total cost picture, comparing older systems to the newer systems. But are there more perhaps qualitative or what we might call soft benefits in terms of the competitiveness of an organization? And do we have any examples of that? And I'm going to throw that out to any of our panelists.
Well, I think what's definitely, I mean, let's be honest here as well. What we have to think about is the target audience out there. I mean, more and more people have access to technology. You know, we have generations now coming up who, you know, just effectively, you know, they want it now and they want it off the web. I think they're used to using the sort of social networking tools that people have become accustomed to. So I think one of the soft, squidgy areas as people go through this transformation, and I'll be honest, I don't think we can put hard dollars or pounds or euros against this at the moment, but I think the inclusion of what I would call, you know, Web 2.0 or Enterprise 2.0 capabilities into applications, you know, we have customers of ours who are now, as it were, trialing that, some of it inside the firewall, some of it beyond. But I think the point being is, one, this can create a much richer, as it were, experience for the user. That's the first thing. And secondly, I think the point being is you begin to address an audience that is used to utilizing these things in their day-to-day life anyway. Why, when they step into the world of the enterprise, you know, do they have to come step back 50 years in terms of what's capable? I mean, you know, you just can't imagine certain things that people require today being done in batch mode anymore. You know, the real-time enterprise, as it was coined, is what people now expect and want. So as people go through this transformation, not only can they do all the plethora of things we've talked about in terms of handwritten code and mainframes and structure and SOA, but they can also start taking steps towards, you know, how they can really get these applications in line and embedded within an internet culture, as you want to call it. And secondly, start to take on board some of the newer concepts around cloud, you know, to experiment, to understand. People aren't going to just make this big leap of faith. End of day, enterprise apps, you know, we make things, supply things, and count things, and people have got to continue to do those. But at the same time, as we said, they need to take these pragmatic steps to introduce these newer technologies that really can help them not only retain their current customer base, but attract new customers as well.
And Paul, also, when organizations go through this transformation and modernize, go to open systems, does that translate into some sort of a business benefit in terms of making that business itself more agile, I guess maybe in a mergers and acquisitions sense? Would somebody resist buying a company because they've got a big mainframe as a sort of albatross around its neck?
I think definitely, you know, the to have your IT fit for purpose is something that I think is part of the inherent health of the organization. I would say that I think, you know, organizations where, you know, their IT is way behind where it is today is definitely part of the health check of an organization. And I would say to some degree, you know, if you don't want to get taken over or merged or acquired, maybe, you know, you just let your IT sag to where it is today with mainframes and legacy apps and nobody will want you. But then I think you're back to where we were earlier. You become one of those 40% of the customers that disappear off the face of the planet. So, you know, it's a sort of, you know, double-edged sword here. Make yourself attractive, you could get merged or acquired. On the other hand, you know, don't do it, and you're going to go out of business. I still think I prefer the former rather than the latter.
Mm. All right, well, let's look a little bit more specifically at what HP is bringing to the table. We've fleshed out this issue quite a bit. Is there a long history at HP of modernization? Again, I'll throw that out to anyone.
I think, well, to put to tee two things up, there's two things. There's what we have done internally within the organization and the company. I mean, we have had to sort of eat our own dog food in the sense that, you know, there are companies that were merged, companies that were acquired, you know, HP, Compaq, Digital, EDS, whatever. You know, and it's just not acceptable anymore to run these as it were, totally separate IT organizations. You have to quickly understand, you know, how do you get this to be an integrated enterprise? So we have been, you know, I think it's been well documented what we have done internally in terms of taking massive amounts of cash, as it were, out of our IT operations, and yet at the same time innovating and providing a better service, at the same time reducing our applications portfolio from something like 15,000 to 3,000. So, I mean, all of these things going on at the same time, and yet that has been achieved with inside HP. Now, you could argue these guys don't have mainframes, so maybe it's easier. Well, maybe that's true. But at the same time, I think modernization has been growing and growing, and now we see it, you know, right up there in the forefront of what organizations believe they need to do to make themselves, you know, cost-effective and, as it were, agile and flexible going forward. Mm. I'll shut up now and let one of the other guys, as it were, compliment on that as well.
John Pickett, what about the issue around standards, neutrality, embracing of heterogeneity, community and open source? Are these issues that HP has found some benefits from?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, it's when you take a look at the history of what we've been able to do of migrating legacy applications onto an open system platform. We actually have a long history of that, and, you know, continue to not only see success, but we're seeing acceleration in those areas. A couple of drivers that we end up seeing, you know, really making the case for customers, not only the significant cost savings that we had talked about earlier, so 50% or 70% TCO savings, driving from a legacy mainframe environment over to an HP environment. But in addition to that, you also have the power savings. Simply by moving, the amount of energy that's saved is enough to light 80 houses for 1 year. We've already talked about the heat, the space savings. It's about a third of what you're going to be seeing for a high-end mainframe environment for a similar system from HP with similar capabilities. And why that's important is because if customers are running out of data center room and they're looking at increasing their compute capacity, but they don't have room within their data center, well, it just makes sense to go with a more efficient, more densely packed power system, you know, with less heat and energy than what you'll see on a legacy environment.
Mm. Brad Hipps, what about this issue about being able to sell from a fairly neutral perspective based on a solutions value? Does that bring something to the table?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we probably alluded earlier to the issue of lock-in. I mean, if we're going to, as we do, kind of fly under the banner of bringing flexibility and agility to an organization, it's tough to wave that banner without being pretty open in who and where you're going to play with. I mean, you know, organizations do have a very fine eye to what's this going to mean for me, not just 6 months from now, but 2 years from now. What's it going to mean to, you know, successors of mine in the organization? And they don't want to be painted into a corner. And you know, that's something that HP is very cognizant of and I think is, you know, kind of historically been very good about. So it's absolutely, I almost see it as a, I mean, you know, this may be a little bit overly optimistic, but I almost see it as kind of a, you have to be able to check that box. If you're going to make a credible argument to kind of any enterprise IT organization, you have to show your openness and you have to be able to check the box that says we're not going to paint you into a corner.
All right, Steve Woods, for those folks that need to get going on this, where do you get started? We mentioned that iterative nature. But there must be perhaps low-lying fruit, demonstrations of value that but then perhaps set up a longer record of success.
Absolutely. And what we find with our customers, they're at various different levels in the process of understanding their legacy systems. Often we find some of them are quite mature or kind of gone down the road quite a bit. We offer some assessments based upon single applications and also portfolio of applications. So we do have a modernization assessment and we do have a portfolio assessment. We also offer a best shore assessment to ensure that you're using the correct resources on which basis of the shore. But often we find we walk into customers and, you know, they just don't know anything about what their options are. They haven't done any sort of analysis thus far. And we offer in those cases, we offer what we're calling a modernization opportunity workshop. And the purpose here is just to is a very quick, usually 4 to 8 hour on-site. It takes about 4 weeks to deliver the entire package. But we use some tools that I have created at HP that looks at the clone code within the application. It's very important to understand the patterns of the clone code and have visualizations. So we have the visual intelligence tools that very quickly allow us to see inside the system, see the duplicate source code, provide them with high-level cost estimates. We use a tool called Kokomo, and we use Monte Carlo simulation. And we're able to give them very quickly a pretty high-level 30-page report that indicates the size. Often size is something that is completely misunderstood. We have been into customers who tell us they have 4 million lines of code, and we actually count the code as only 400,000 lines of code. So it's important to start with sort of a stake in the ground, understand exactly where you are at with the size. We also do a functional decomposition. It's important to understand that. And that's all delivered with very little impact because we know the subject matter experts are very busy, and we try to lessen the impact of doing that. So that's one of the places we can start when a customer just has so much uncertainty that it's not even certain where to start at.
Well, great. We've been discussing the high penalties that can come with inaction around applications and legacy systems. And we've been talking about how that factors into the economy and the technological shifts around open systems and more choices that also offer the path to agility and perhaps multiple sourcing options. So I want to thank our panelists today for our discussion about the high costs and perhaps risks inherent in doing nothing around legacy systems. We've been joined by Brad Hipps, product marketer for Application Lifecycle Management and Applications Portfolio Software at HP. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.
John Pickett, Enterprise Storage and Server Marketing at HP. Thank you, John.
Oh, thank you, Dana.
Paul Evans, Worldwide Marketing Lead on Applications Transformation at HP. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Dana.
And Steve Woods, Applications Transformation Analyst and Distinguished Software Engineer at EDS. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Dana.
This is Dana Gardner, Principal Analyst at Inter Arbor Solutions. You've been listening to a sponsored Briefings Direct podcast. Thanks for listening, and come back next time.